San Francisco, and I'll be chairing the symposium today. The importance and urgency of addressing HIV and TB is one of the visible themes of this conference. We have invited four speakers this afternoon to address some of the key topics in the area of HIV and TB. We'll hear from Haile Jesus Gedehun about the global progress in addressing the epidemic, Mark Perkins about diagnostics, Soumya Swaminathan about treatment issues, and Allison Grant about issues regarding prevention. What we'll do for the symposium, as opposed to having the questions all at the end, the speakers will give approximately a 15-minute talk, and then we'll have about 5 minutes for questions for each speaker. For your questions, kindly come up to the microphone and identify yourself. So it's a real pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Haile Jesus Gedehun. Dr. Gedehun works in the WHO in the TB department. He also works in the secretariat for the working group for the HIV-TB subgroup of the Stop TB Partnership. Dr. Gedehun has worked tirelessly in terms of bringing the HIV and TB fields together. He recently led the initiative to reevaluate the current guidelines for the approach and diagnosis of tuberculosis in the setting of smear-negative disease, which led to a complete change in the guidelines now endorsed by the WHO and the broader community. Today, he's going to review where we are at in terms of addressing HIV-TB from a global perspective and also give us a brief overview of what's happening with XDR-TB. So without further ado, Dr. Gedehun.
Thank you, Dan. In my presentation, I would give a quick note of the importance of TB in HIV care and then summarize the key milestones in the global response for this epidemic, and then also present the key components of the WHO HIV-TB policy and where we are in terms of implementing the recommendations of that policy. And then I will give a quick brief update on the XDR-TB and finally highlight the challenge and conclude. A third of the estimated 40 million people living with HIV are co-infected with TB. And we have adequate evidence to show the importance of TB in people living with HIV. One study that came out from Stephen Long Group from Cape Town showed that both prevalent as well as incident TB are common and associated with high mortality between 15% to 20% among people living with HIV and on ART. And this effect also goes beyond the ART clinic into the community level. And the graph shows, which is presented by Matthias Inger in the last CROI conference in Los Angeles, shows that TB is now the most common prevalent opportunistic infection on people living with HIV and on ART. And this is a quote from the Lancet editorial when the XDR-TB report was published in last August, which says failure to act now to contain the threat posed by XDR-TB will have devastating consequences for patients with TB, particularly those co-infected with HIV/AIDS. This graph summarizes the key milestones in the global fight against this co-infection. As we all know, the relationship between TB and HIV was known since the early 80s when the first AIDS cases were described. And this was followed in the late 80s by increased TB case notifications for in those countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, with high HIV prevalence. And this has necessitated in 1989 the first ever WHO consultation meeting on TB-HIV. But unfortunately, the key conclusion of that meeting has been really to focus on the public health aspect and as well as on the infectious cases which are the smear negative and to build on the provision of short course chemotherapy, which later was named as DOTS. And the key conclusion of this meeting has probably contributed almost for the no action on HIV-TB for the next decade. And it's only in 1997 that WHO has started pilot protest projects which promote HIV testing for TB patients as an entry for comprehensive care, which was in 1998 followed by a UNAIDS WHO policy on the provision of IPT as part of package of care for HIV. And in 2000, the World Health Assembly, which is all member states gather, a TB resolution for the first time addressed the importance of HIV in TB control. And this was soon followed by the establishment of the Global TB HIV Working Group Secretariat of the Stop TB Partnership, which was quite instrumental in stimulating implementation of activities by countries by serving as a forum for exchange of experience and best practices. And this has also coordinated the development of package of policies and minimum guidelines to accelerate implementation. And in 2004, WHO has developed the TB-HIV policy. And this policy has the principles of acknowledging that DOTS alone is not sufficient to tackle TB in HIV prevalent settings, so that we need patient-focused integrated services. We also acknowledge that there is ongoing catastrophe, but at the same time, very little evidence to build our interventions. But there is a need for a rapid scale-up of those activities, those interventions that proved working. And there is also a need to revise as more evidence evolves. The epidemiology of HIV is also important while defining the interventions, and all countries, notwithstanding to their HIV status, should be able to implement interventions. And this policy also calls for the establishment of no separate HIV-TB or TB-HIV program. However, the interventions should be mainstreamed into the existing HIV and TB strategies. So these are the 12 collaborative TB-HIV activities. The first set of activities are those which are targeted at establishing the mechanism of collaboration between the two programs, and which is basically a responsibility of both the HIV and the TB control programs, which is the second set of activities are those activities targeted at decreasing the burden of TB in people living with HIV, and basically responsibilities of HIV control program. And the last set of activities are those activities intended to decrease the burden of HIV in TB patients and primarily responsibilities of the TB control program. Now we have enough policy guidelines to accelerate the implementation of TB-HIV activities. And this slide shows all WHO policy guidance documents to assist countries to implement activities. So where are we now? And this WHO started to document the progress of implementation of activities in 2002. And this graph shows the annual TB control report, which WHO releases after receiving reports from countries. So as you can see it from this slide, the first set of numbers shows those countries who reported that they are providing HIV testing for TB patients, and those countries also who reported for WHO. So, for example, in 2002, there were 210 countries reported to WHO, out of which only 7 were having policies that help HIV TB patients to get HIV testing. But this has increased rapidly into 62, 69, and in 2005, there were 92 countries. And the number of TB patients notified over these years has also increased from 3 million in 2002 to 5 million in 2005. So when we see, in a nutshell, the progress of activities, all activities globally, there is, as you can see, it's from this bar chart, there is quite impressive and rapid progress in the last 2 years as compared to the previous 2 years. But in general, the activities are too little when we consider with the magnitude of the problem. For example, if we take HIV testing for TB patients, it's only 7% of TB patients that are tested for HIV in 2005. And as you can see, most of the burden also concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa, and almost all countries are testing less below 15% of their patients. Likewise, when we see the number of patients, estimated HIV positive TB patients detected globally, it's only 14% of those estimated HIV positive patients are detected by health services within these countries. And again, the data is very, very low in sub-Saharan Africa. This is another interesting finding in which all HIV positive people should be screened for TB. That is one of the policy. But as you can see it, it's only less than 0.5% of people living with HIV are screened for TB. And the report is coming also from very handful countries, and particularly from Africa, where the burden of the magnitude of the problem is high. It's only Ethiopia and South Africa who are reporting screening of TB among HIV positives. Likewise, there were only 26,000 of people living with HIV put on isoniazid preventive therapy in 2005. Again, very handful countries report this. So, despite these global numbers, there are certain encouraging success stories coming up. One, as depicted on this slide, is from Rwanda, where they were able to increasingly increase the number of HIV tests for TB patients and the services provided over the last 2005 and 2006. For example, they were able to test 69% of their TB patients and provide 12% of them with ART in 2005, which has increased into 31% in 2006. TB screening, likewise, is also another increasing activity in Rwanda. They developed a questionnaire-based survey tool to detect, to screen 76% of their patients and to put them on 8% of them on treatment. That means previously undiagnosed TB. Kenya, which has a target of 80% by the end of 2010, was also able to increase the number of HIV testing over the years. Likewise, the provision of ketoconazole and antiretroviral treatment for TB patients has also increased in the last 2 years in Kenya. So what are the factors that helped Kenya and Rwanda to exceed in these services? Is one is creating conducive policy environment and also giving program guidance. But increasing access to HIV testing was the crucial factor that helped these countries. Particularly in Kenya, the Ministry of Health was promoting the, a sort of national policy saying not offering HIV testing to persons presenting with HIV-associated illness, including TB, is a substandard care, which had a very powerful in order to encourage health workers to offer HIV testing for TB patients. Otherwise, intensive continuous training and supervision and supply of commodities was also useful. This is XDR, a slide that summarizes XDR and the publication from the Lancet from the KwaZulu-Natal in August, where they were isolated almost 1,500 sputum specimens, where 35% of them were culture positive, and out of that, almost 40% were with MDR, and 10% or 53 cases were having extensively drug-resistant TB. And all those 44 out of these 53 tested for HIV were positive, and 52 out of 53 were dead, within a median survival date of 16 years. And this study also shows that there is huge risk of nosocomial transmission, as evidenced by 51% of them were not having no prior TB treatment, and 67 were with prior hospitalization, and also 6 health workers died. So by March 2007, according to the information to WHO, there were 555 XDR cases in South Africa that were reported, and 267 were from Tugela Ferry. And this is a graph to show countries that are reported an XDR cases by this month, and there are 37 countries. As you can see it from Africa, because of the difficulty of laboratory and capacity to diagnose XDR-TB, it's only South Africa, which has the capacity and also reported cases. So the key challenges are poor health system, as always, and the health workforce, failure to recognize the importance of TB and HIV by both TB as well as HIV program managers, and lack of integration of services and best practices, and above all, poor diagnostic capacity. And we are still in a technology vacuum, being relying on sputum microscopy, which has been invented in the last century. And the another limiting factor is centralized ART, mostly in hospitals, and decentralized TB services, mostly to health centers and lower peripheral health units. And above all, also, we have many unanswered priority research questions. In conclusion, there is encouraging progress in implementation, but too little. And there is too little global investment in TB and HIV TB research to catalyze this rapid implementation of activities. And the encouraging progress of implementation, which calls for more implementation, will necessitate more research questions that has to be addressed, and we need more investment and interest for HIV-TB research. And this graph is what I took from the Treatment Action Group report in last year, in which they compared NIH investment with TB and HIV. The red one represents HIV research, and the green one, TB. And in 2005, there was almost nearly $3 billion as compared to $300 million for TB. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll take questions now. Haile Jesus, I'm going to start asking you two questions. One is, could you please comment on the WHO's approach or the global approach to do surveillance for XDR in view of the recent events? And the second question is to comment on the WHO role and what they're doing now for infection control.
Regarding surveillance for XDR-TB, I mean, the WHO, the TB network, particularly in collaboration with the International Union Against TB and Lung Diseases, has been running TB drug surveillance, drug-resistant surveillance since 1994, which has been very instrumental and increasingly expanding, covering many countries now. And the results are always published in high-profile journals. And now after, but that is only focusing on first-line drugs. But after the emergence of extensively drug-resistant TB, and now there is awareness, and the problem is there is huge difficulty in doing drug accessibility testing for second-line TB drugs. And now there is huge effort as part of the global response for XDR that to encourage for countries, for at least the southern African countries, to prepare themselves to strengthen laboratories and also to assess the extent of the problem. And I know there are several attempts and initiatives are going on in most of those countries to come up with surveillance, but the surveillance is Difficult to do it within the continent, and the specimens must have to be transported to Europe or other laboratories. But at the same time, there is huge effort to build the capacity of laboratories and in development of supranational laboratories in Africa. Regarding the second question, infection control, again, XDR has really exposed the neglect of TB infection control and its particular association with high mortality in people living with HIV also is another urgent action. And taking this into consideration, actually the Stop TB partnership has developed, has established the infection control subgroup, which will come under the TB-HIV working group, and the secretariat will be in WHO. And currently, the group is working to revise the guidelines of addressing TB infection control in healthcare and other congregate settings, including long-haul flights. And we are hoping that that will be finalized in the next couple of weeks.
I'll ask one more question. Case-based finding, where are we at? Do you think that that's within the near future we're going to be able to implement that, and what's happening in the field?
Intensified case finding? I think the problem with intensified case finding is, again, is an issue of TB, you know, easy tools to diagnose TB. We still rely on microscopy, which at the minimum is taking a couple of days, and also culture, which takes weeks. But there are certain encouraging experiences coming from countries where they used symptomatology screening questionnaire really to screen, particularly among people living with HIV. And there is a call now to have a standard TB screening tool that will be utilized both by HIV as well as TB service providers. And we are embarking in developing that tool.
Do we have any data on whether there are strains that have been seen cross borders, or are all these strains identified in the various countries individual outbreaks?
I have no data on that. I cannot comment.
Yes, microphone two.
My name is Edwin Mapara from Zambia and Botswana. My question is, how strong is WHO when it comes to implementing the program in Africa? Why I'm asking, in Zambia in 1989, when I was looking after the TB ward, we made it a point that all TB patients being discharged were screened for HIV. Going to Botswana, we did the same. Initially, there was a bit of resistance, but we knew the relationship between TB and HIV. That was 1990. Now, when we talk of these figures, where you find so many, Kenya and Rwanda have done well, and South Africa. One question, I say, we are losing so many lives. WHO is there, and you've got WHO reps in all these African countries. Is it difficult to get that structure in WHO to the country level? That's my question.
Yeah, I think this is a good point, but I think it has to be clear what is the mandate of WHO. WHO is assisting countries and, you know, developing policies, norms, and, you know, advocate for their implementation. And the final implementation is in the hands of countries. Yes, WHO is assisting, brokering with different partners, funding agencies, to encourage the implementation of these policies. But the TB-HIV situation is a bit different because it involves collaboration and coordination basically between two different entities, the HIV as well as the TB. TB has been there for centuries, and the TB control programs, basically focusing on, you know, from the public health aspect on infectious cases, mostly, you know, broad-based public health interventions on DOTS. And whereas HIV is really quite young and new and, you know, mostly focusing on, you know, patient-centered approach. And this has really two different philosophical approach. And reconciling this is not easy. And there are good trends that are coming now, but it needs a lot of work. So that needs collaboration from both sectors, HIV as well as TB community, including you, HIV researchers, or whoever is here.
Okay, thank you very much. Our next speaker is Dr. Mark Perkins. He is the Scientific Director of the Foundation for Innovative New Diagnostics, or FIND, a very topical area after the last talk that we heard. It's certainly no secret that diagnosis is the Achilles heel of getting control of TB, and particularly in our HIV-infected population. I do think there's some very exciting developments. We're really delighted that Mark was able to come and join us for the symposium to both outline the scope of the problem and some of the potential solutions. So, Mark.
Thank you, Diane. It's first, I want to say it's a great privilege to talk to the energized and enthusiastic and very active HIV community. For those of us who usually talk to the somewhat more sleepy tropical disease and TB groups. What I want to talk about today is, as Diana mentioned, some of the size of the problem of diagnosing TB, especially as an infected by HIV, and some of the approaches we're taking and trying to remedy that. I was impressed downstairs at the amount of biotechnology being thrown at the HIV diagnostic problem, both for diagnosis and monitoring, and comparing that a little bit to the TB world. You see, in TB, we have an advantage that that TB is visible under a microscope, and you can see it in people who have disease. So this is Robert Koch's microscope with which he first found the organism itself and in fact proved that it was a bacterial pathogen causing the illness and not some sort of emotional factor on the part of the patient. And we've evolved since then. So the fundamental diagnostic tool from 1882 has turned into the fundamental diagnostic tool of 2007. And I'm actually not joking here. There are about 50,000 laboratories in the world performing some 90 million microscopy exams for TB worldwide. So compared to malaria and many other diseases where microscopy works but has been more or less abandoned as too difficult to do, in TB, there's quite a huge network of laboratories doing microscopy daily. Most patients don't have access to other microbiologic services, so only about 5% of patients living in endemic countries in Africa and Asia have culture, for example, performed, and almost all have only microscopy. Now, there's two big problems with microscopy. One is sensitivity, and one is the difficulty in implementing. And those can be shown on this slide here. These are projected smear-positive cases that have more than 10,000 bacteria per mil in their sputum. Those other patients down here are those who have too few bacteria to be easily visible in microscopy. So as you can see, the insensitivity of the microscopy means that more than half of patients aren't picked up and, in fact, cannot be picked up by microscopy. If you take this half of patients who have smear-positive tuberculosis, roughly half of them are not picked up and reported by microscopy, either because it never gets done or because it gets done badly. So implementation of microscopy and the sensitivity of microscopy are huge problems. HIV has made this much worse. As you know, all the immunologic changes that are associated with advanced HIV infection make extrapulmonary disease and diminished cavity formation and lower concentrations of AFB in sputum remarkably, so that microscopy sensitivity is even lower than it normally would be for HIV-negative individuals. This has very important implications for TB care. So as I mentioned, normally, if you go back a slide, if you normally say if you're a physician working somewhere and you know that only 30 or 40% of your patients are likely to be microscopy positive who are symptomatic, and you cut that in half in a TB, in an HIV prevalent area, it really erodes both the patient's faith in the health system to diagnose them, and also, in fact, the caregivers themselves' faith in the laboratory to ever help them out. So in routine, traditional HIV negative tuberculosis, we watch this pathway from as the patient develops progressive disease over many months until they finally reach a level of a bacterial burden where they become smear positive, diagnosable by microscopy. During this time, all kinds of illness accrues and transmission inside the family. Past this point is, in fact, where we mostly diagnose patients, where they have large numbers of mycobacteria in sputum and are transmitting avidly in the community. The superimposed problem in HIV that is so remarkable is you don't just get more morbidity down here, but you get, in fact, aggressive mortality has been shown. I mean, Tony Harries and his group showing some nice studies that in patients seeking a diagnosis for tuberculosis, those who were smear negative, as many as half died on the way to trying to get a diagnosis to find out what was wrong with them. And a number of very nice autopsy studies done in sub-Saharan Africa as well as India and Brazil showing 30 to 75% disseminated TB in HIV-infected individuals dying, many undiagnosed prior to death. So smear-negative tuberculosis turns out to have even a higher mortality than smear-positive tuberculosis in some HIV-infected communities, in part because some of that smear-negative TB isn't TB and it gets treated for TB, and in part because it reflects the advanced HIV disease that's associated with smear-negative TB often. So one of the outcomes of that is that if you have untreated TB, whether it's because it's untreatable or because you don't get around to it, there's relatively aggressive mortality. Javier mentioned this Tegucigalpa outbreak. The remarkable thing I want to point to here is not that it is XDR-TB. What I want to say is this was untreated tuberculosis. That is, in patients not getting adequate therapy, 52 of 53 dying in a short period of time shows you that untreated tuberculosis in HIV-infected individuals can be rapidly fatal. Now, this shouldn't really be news to us. If we look back 10 years, 15 years in the United States and outbreaks in Florida, New Jersey, and New York, you saw a similar thing in very high mortality in a very short time period in those outbreaks of tuberculosis, in that case, MDR-TB, but again, untreated tuberculosis in HIV-infected individuals. So you now have a remarkably bad situation in tuberculosis and HIV where you have a very difficult diagnosed disease where the physician is left to guess in the majority of cases. And it strikes me there's very few diseases like this. A burden annually of 9 million cases, routinely fatal if untreated, and the physician has no diagnostic tools to direct therapy that is, in fact, requires daily observation for 6 months. So if there's a good outcome from that, from these XDR outbreaks, is that now people who have deep pockets can worry about their sons and daughters being infected on airplanes. What we hope this turns into is an advanced effort to try to drive along the development pathway new products for tuberculosis. And FIND is a publicly funded agency that's trying to do just that, identify novel technologies that have application in TB and develop them in a contractual setting that allows us to control intellectual property and the pricing of the final product so it can be affordable and available in the developing world. It's important when you think about developing diagnostic products to imagine exactly where they will be applied in the world, and it's important, especially in the developing world, to think about what level of laboratory service you would have, both because higher levels of laboratories will have greater capability and can put in greater technology, but also because the kind of information you might want at different levels of the health system may be different. So this suffices just to say that I will talk about each of these levels of the health system as I go very quickly through a number of technologies that we're in the process of developing. You don't need to look at this slide in detail, look at these names. I'll talk about some of these technologies, but simply to point out to you that in the pipeline here, we have a number of technologies that are, in fact, maturing over the coming 2 to 5 years. The red dot in this point says STAG, but substitute international agency approval, submission to WHO, etc. So our normal pipeline takes us through development, evaluation, and a regulatory quality trial, large-scale demonstration studies scaled up in-country to look at feasibility and impact, and then with this effectiveness data driving policy change. So we expect that policy change will happen for a number of new diagnostic technologies in the coming years. So this is not drugs or vaccines where you expect a product development timeline of decades. This is diagnostics are relatively rapid and less expensive to develop, which is, of course, exciting for us. Now, what can you do to improve the diagnostic situation? How can we make it easier to diagnose patients? Traditional solid media culture takes a long time. We can cut that in half using liquid media systems, either manual ones or in automated daily reading systems that are made by two or three companies. These are still central laboratory processing requirements, and they're relatively cumbersome to use. We've been looking now at the feasibility of implementing rapid culture to improve the diagnosis of TB and HIV infected individuals in a number of countries. We have a number of collaborators in the audience here, but we have, I think, now nearly 140,000 patients who will be getting access to liquid culture through these demonstration projects to look at how well that can be used in the developing world. One of the problems with liquid culture is that you grow anything, including a number of non-tuberculous mycobacteria, other species that don't actually necessarily cause the disease. It's been in the past quite difficult to determine what the species was, and you needed long phenotypic testing systems or rapid molecular tests that are quite expensive to differentiate species. We've been working now to make available a rapid dipstick method that allows you in 15 minutes to see whether what grew in the culture was in fact TB. There are other ways to do rapid liquid culture. There's commercial systems and then there's non-commercial systems. This is one that's been published on several times recently that's been called MODS, that's simply looking through a microscope, an inverted microscope, for tiny microcolonies in liquid of the mycobacteria as they grow. And in fact, if you add in some of these wells antibiotics, you can look both for growth of the tuberculosis in the control well and inhibition in the antibiotic well and get drug resistance information in the same speed that you get culture information. This is from a chart in the New England Journal from David Moore and his colleagues showing that, in fact, there was very impressive performance in terms of speed, that automated mycobacterial culture was fast. MODS appeared to be faster. And what's really interesting here is that the showing that the optical methods decrease the time frames almost regardless of the bacterial burden, rather than waiting for the accumulation of metabolites or oxygen consumption as commercial systems do. So MODS is very attractive, but it's hardly a simple solution. These are the materials that are needed to put together your own homebrew liquid culture in your laboratory. It's difficult to picture scaling this up and spreading it out to thousands of laboratories around the world. Now let's talk about those thousands of laboratories for just a second. This is a chart looking at the laboratory capacity for TB testing. And looking at the numbers of laboratories of different types. Over here you have microscopy centers, some 57,000 worldwide, 40,000 in the high-burden countries here. If you look at the number of culture laboratories in the public sector, there's 2,000 in the high-burden countries, but 92% of the culture capacity and DST capacity is in just a few countries. If you look at those laboratories that have a DST capacity, it's even fewer. In fact, there are 11 of the 22 high-burden countries have less than 2 drug susceptibility testing facilities at all, and 13 of 22 have less than 3 culture systems. That means if you live in Nigeria, where there's only one laboratory in the entire nation that has capacity to do culture, the chance that you would ever actually have access to culture is very, very small. So scaling up any of these growth-based methods is going to be very difficult without a massive improvement in laboratory infrastructure. Just a safety note, the STAG, the Strategic and Technical Advisory Group of WHO, in 2007 made the recommendations that there be at least BSL-2 or BSL-3 facilities, BSL-3, for all laboratories doing drug susceptibility testing for TB. So any of you who've ever put together a BSL-3 laboratory, imagine scaling that up worldwide. It's a huge undertaking. So now we've got with liquid culture, we've shortened the time from maybe a month to a couple of weeks. How can we go faster? This is a phage-based methodology, which uses a mycobacteriophage to actually infect the TB bacilli in sputum, and then you add a viricide, killing the exogenous phage, and plate that out on some rapidly growing sensor cells, Mycobacterium smegmatis, and simply do a plaque assay. The next morning, look for plaques. So you put these in the incubator, and you look the next morning, you see clear places where, in fact, everywhere there was a TB organism, there's now a plaque. This has now been commercially developed and manufactured in collaboration with FIND by a company called Biotech. It's called the Fast Plaque Assay. We were unable to get the sensitivity of this assay for detection of TB as high as we wanted it. We were able to show that, however, you could add rifampin to one vial and leave the other vial control, and in smear-positive patients have a 48-hour test for drug resistance that's highly accurate compared to conventional methods. So this is one of the tested methods that's being rolled out in South Africa and other countries. Another approach to this is the molecular approach. There are two companies, one called Inogenetics and one called Hine, that make an assay that's a simply conventional PCR, amplifying some of the genes that are associated with drug resistance in TB, and then having the oligos line up on a reverse line probe hybridization assay that you can simply look at and see bands. And then if you have clever enough eyes and can read the chart, you can tell exactly the rifampin resistance phenotype or genotype by looking at the strips. This particular assay, genotype MDR-TB+, which we're using in South Africa, also gives at least those genes responsible for isoniazid resistance that we understand well. This is these two test methods, the phage method and the line probe method, allow rapid turnaround for drug susceptibility testing, which allows you to do some things on a programmatic level that we were unable to do before. So this is what the situation in Peru in 2000, where normally about 2% of patients in Peru off the street who had TB had MDR-TB, 98% had drug-sensitive TB. The scheme at the time was to treat them for 6 months, and those who failed to treat them for another 9 months with another regimen, and at that point call them MDR-TB and put them on an MDR regimen with no testing for drug resistance at any point. So we've been marching backward now, trying to implement drug susceptibility testing earlier and earlier. The earliest we've done that is now in South Africa. If you look at the 2006 South African DST policy, who gets tested? Clinical failures after those 6 to 18 months of treatment, bacteriologic failures, et cetera, known MDR contacts. And now the 2007 policy is to, for all smear-positive patients, do a rapid test within 24, 48 hours, being able to know if they're rifampin-resistant or susceptible and put them on an appropriate regimen. For all smear-negative cases, to culture them with a rapid liquid culture system and, again, direct therapy based on a rapid tested method. So South Africa is quite an unusual country, not like the rest of the world, but it does show that these two new methods can have a public health impact. I'm going to skip a couple of things here and talk about two or three exciting technologies that are on the horizon for the lower level of the health system, microscopy level. This is a molecular method that we've been developing. I don't know if there's a mouse here. That we've been developing with a company in Japan called Aiken Chemical Company. And most of you won't care about this animation, so we can skip it. But basically, it is a isothermal amplification system that uses a clever series of primers that end up making a stem loop structure that the DNA polymerase never has to get up. Once it sits down, rapidly amplifies huge amounts of DNA, maybe 100 or 1,000 times as much DNA as in PCR, all isothermally in a water bath or a heat block. And gives you, interestingly, a visible readout so you can pick them up and read with the naked eye of whether or not you've got a PCR, an amplification product. We've spent the last couple of years now trying to simplify this system down into something you could take into the microscopy level. So we just had our first JCM publication last year. We took it to Tanzania, Bangladesh, and Peru, and ran this assay in a microscopy level laboratory on the open benchtop with people with no molecular training. So it's really the first time that we've been able to take molecular technologies to the developing world and apply them to an enormous public health problem. Another approach to this that we're using is in collaboration with a company called Cepheid in California, and this is basically using a very sophisticated microfluidic device where you simply put sputum directly into this device with no treatment, push it in the box, push the door, say start, and in 90 minutes it tells you, does that patient have TB and is it rifampin resistant or not? So this is obviously simple enough to use the microscopy level, but may not be appropriate for many microscopy level laboratories where computers walk away, etc. I will skip to the last couple of slides. This is a slide just off the streets in Peru to remind us that if you look at the lowest level of the health system, in primary care or at the drugstore, the only kind of diagnostic tests that make it there are dipstick-type technologies for glucose testing or pregnancy. So that's really the aim of what you'd like for a handheld method. There are about 30 or 40 companies making rapid TB detection assays using TB antibody. We tested about 19 of those, and if you look at those that had high specificity here, the sensitivity was 20 to 30%. So these current assays really don't perform at a level that you'd like to use them. All of those current assays have only been using maybe 4 or 5 antigens out of the 4,000 in the TB proteome. So we've gone back with collaborators at Import in California and PHRI in New Jersey and have cloned and expressed every single protein in the TB proteome, put it on chips, and are now interrogating those with large numbers of patient sera to see if we can identify a diagnostic antigen set. The last technology I'll mention is antigen detection, that is trying to actually find TB antigens in patient samples. There's a number of pieces of data, some quite old at this point, a decade old, showing that, for example, this glycolipid, lipoprotein, can be found in TB patients in the urine and not in healthy controls. We've been pursuing this, in fact, even with a company that developed a polyclonal antibody against Lam, and we took it to the field in Tanzania and showed for smear-positive patients, not the kind of sensitivity we wanted, only 62%, a third of smear-negative patients. An interesting finding here was that the HIV-positive patients were much more likely to be Lam-positive in their urine than the HIV-negative patients, suggesting that these, not surprisingly, patients who had disseminated disease might be excreting mycobacterial products in their urine, and if we improve the testing methods, maybe we could do better. This is another example of that, showing that there's an inverse relationship between the amount of mycobacterial antigens in urine and the degree of immunosuppression. This is my last slide. It's simply saying that I'm hoping now that with these new technologies coming out that we will change this paradigm, and the fundamental diagnostic tool from 2007 will not be the fundamental diagnostic by 2012. Thank you very much. I'll stand here.
Thank you, Mark. While people are coming up to the microphones, Mark, looking at the overview and the obstacles to doing very widespread scale-up of liquid media cultures, do you, in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, what do you see as the most promising technology that could bring us to the next level in terms of improving diagnostics? I mean, in HIV, even tests like HIV RNA, which are not accessible widespread in centers of excellence, are becoming a lot more available. And you've probably seen that, you know, at this meeting. What do you think, how could we link to TB diagnostics, and what do you think would be the best way to go?
Two answers to that. Everyone always asks me what the answer is. We're not there yet in terms of what's the right technology. My sense is that the difficulty of implementing safe and quality-controlled culture systems that are going to be speedy enough throughout sub-Saharan Africa, it's going to be so difficult that people are going to want to shortcut that to molecular testing systems. Tests that give you an answer in 1 day or 2 days versus even 12 or 15 days have a remarkably different impact. So I think if we can develop molecular test systems such as the two I mentioned that can be implemented at microscopy level or even slightly higher, that could have a very big impact. It gives us the possibility also to integrate TB and HIV care around a diagnostic test. So the Cepheid platform that we I mentioned, we've just received funding to also develop HIV testing on that same platform so that these systems could go into HIV testing, HIV care laboratories or clinics where patients get both their viral load and rapid testing for TB within 90 minutes.
Jerry?
Jerry Friedland, thank you, Mark. This feels a little bit like Alice in Wonderland, even in South Africa, where it sounded like all of that was in place, and yet it's under study right now and nowhere near available to the average patient or person in the field. So that, just a comment. But I was wondering if there's any thought or even development of the next generation of tests that would look at second-line drug resistance, since the rifampin-based tests, which would be wonderful when they're available, will identify MDR, but not really tell us about XDR, and at least in settings and probably increasingly around the world, XDR is going to become more and more prominent, and we'll still be faced then with the dilemma of not knowing whether that's present or not when MDR is diagnosed.
So, yes, you're absolutely right that there's demonstration projects in South Africa, these technologies, but that doesn't mean that the world has changed and that now everyone has access to MDR testing or even rapid testing for TB at any site. And South Africa is quite, as you know, quite different than the rest of Africa in terms of the centralization of the laboratory testing. So I don't expect that model to even be applicable for many countries in Africa if it works. In answer to your second question, we have just actually made an agreement to fund a development of an assay to look for XDR. I have to say I've done this with some trepidation. We made a promise to ourselves not to develop and distribute MDR tests for MDR-TB where there wasn't treatment for MDR-TB available. So I have a little bit of a struggle with what I do with an XDR diagnostic test, but maybe you can help me understand.
Well, I think, you know, that everyone does point to the 53 patients and 52 died and the 98% mortality. And part of that is because of delayed recognition of XDR-TB. And there still is, I think, were we able to actually diagnose it sooner rather than wait the months until the test comes back, and most of those patients are diagnosed, as you know, post-mortem, then there might still be some opportunities for treatment. And of those new cases that Dr. Gedehun described, although it's not very optimistic, the mortality with XDR-TB in Tegela-Ferry has fallen to 85% from 98%. So I think, like with most terrible diseases, the worst ones appear first, and there may be a group of people still, even with HIV infection, who have XDR who still may survive and be even treatable with some of the available drugs. So I wouldn't, you know, say that, in fact, at this point in time, it's untreatable because it is probably close to reality, but not necessarily in the future, particularly if we had diagnostic tests that would allow us to make that diagnosis more rapidly.
Well, you can help us evaluate their impact when they're developed.
Okay, good.
Oh, up on one.
Elena Vieta from Argentina. I was wondering, two questions. First, if you were a health minister in Latin America, let's say. And second, if you are a doctor working with HIV people suffering from TB, which smear negative, in case you are the health minister and a good scenario, even in Latin America. And second, if you are the doctor, which tests would you like to see that you have, that you can handle?
So luckily I'm not the health minister from a Latin American country. I would worry about losing my job quickly, because they frequently do, unfortunately. The first answer is you would use a test that has been completed development, has been evaluated thoroughly in clinical trials, where you know the performance, and then has been demonstrated to work in the setting in which you, the kinds of setting in which you live. So many of the technologies I talked about have not gone through that process yet. So whether or not we can take the existing traditional benchtop PCR assays and really use them in developing world settings needs to be proven. That being said, I think everyone agrees that the sooner you can get the information back, the better, and the closer to the patient you can deliver the result, the better. If I had enough capacity, I would probably work very hard to develop clinical algorithms that I could plug existing assays into that would allow me to abbreviate the diagnostic process. I know that's an imperfect answer, but that's where I'd like to stick.
Brent Sashir from Chicago and Project Hope. I'd like your opinion on task shifting to address human resource deficiencies in laboratory services. I was glad to hear you talk about microscopy, even though we're all trying to look ahead to better diagnostic technologies. But in the meantime, adequate access just to simple microscopy for the 40% that will be positive with HIV-TB infection is still lacking in many parts, and actually getting worse, not better, with reporting and quality assurance. And so we're embarking on a program, I think, reluctantly, understanding its limitations, but this is the diagnostic technology we have. And both training and assistance with quality assurance is really a critical part of that. And it's difficult to commit resources to training for that while waiting for these other technologies, but maybe you'd comment on it.
I think I don't see it as a waste at all. If you can't perform microscopy well, it's unlikely you'll be able to perform PCR well, certainly. So any of the technologies other than the dipstick solution that we all want, that I've been talking about, will require trained people working in quality controlled environments. So I would think that those are perfect investments, are reasonable investments.
Microphone one.
Thank you very much. Trevor Kaile from Zambia, Chief Medical Officer for Salvation Army Health Services. Now, we work in the limited rural setup where resources are very limited, and we have seen very impressive technologies here. Now, our worry is the imaging resistance patterns, especially on the TB. And now we see all these good things here, but we don't have any access. What is the availability so that we can use some of these things in the rural areas where most of the people are? And thank you.
Yeah, the availability right now is zero. These technologies have not completed development, are not for sale, other than the culture systems that I mentioned and the phage system that I mentioned. One of the molecular tests that I mentioned, the line probe assay, is available but cannot really be used in a rural setting. So there is no availability right now. So it is as dire as you paint it to be. The hope is, and the intention is, that within 3 years we will have molecular technologies that can be used quite peripherally. Whether that means rurally or not, I don't know, and that needs to be learned. We are still 5 years away from a technology that would be able to deliver the kinds of simplicity performance that you're looking for, I suspect.
Microphone two.
Yeah, Hans van Grevel. I'm working in Indonesia. Many of the problems you point to are very relevant. One thing we may sometimes forget is that with the current diagnostics, there's still room for improvement. There have been two diagnostic trials looking at patient instruction for better sputum sampling. The last one from Pakistan, a beautiful big trial recently published in The Lancet, which showed a very big increase in the yield of sputum microscopy after 2 minutes of instruction to patients for better samples.
I think that's a really good point. I was also impressed with that study. We have to pay attention to all parts of the diagnostic process and not just the technology we apply. We did a study in Zambia looking at diagnostic delay, and one part of the study was to look at what percentage of the patients that were told they should get sputum microscopy actually did it. It turned out that that month the national system ran out of sputum cups and the patients had to pay for them. They were 25 cents. 3 of 600 patients got their sputum exams done that month.
Great. Thank you very much, Mark. Thanks to the audience, too, for a great discussion. And Mark, I think you can see the interest in the audience, and I wouldn't underestimate what the HIV community can do, even in the rural areas, if you can get us the tests. So we hope that 3 to 5 year timeline that's realized. Our next speaker is Dr. Soumya Swaminathan. Dr. Swaminathan is a researcher and a clinician who leads up the HIV-TB research program at the Tuberculosis Research Center in Chennai, India. She's a pediatrician by training, and we're really delighted that she's going to share with us her perspectives on the therapeutic challenges in HIV-TB.
Thank you, and good evening. I come from India, where the estimated prevalence of HIV among TB patients overall is about 5%. So that's in yellow, as opposed to the countries in red, which are over 50%. But there are pockets in India where we have an HIV prevalence of greater than 15 or even 20% amongst TB patients. And there are others where it's still less than 2%. So we have huge diversity. Just to remind ourselves of the clinical situation that all of you who are physicians are used to seeing: a young woman who acquired HIV from her husband through marriage and found out she was positive when she was pregnant, delivered a baby boy, and then went on to have fever and weight loss and was found to have disseminated TB with miliary and meningeal TB and was very, very sick. The things that I'm going to talk about today are the impact of TB on HIV and why we need to start HART urgently and to try and address the issue of when during TB treatment, what regimens it can be used, some of the challenges that we face, and what about patients on second-line drugs. Well, very briefly, I want to go through some of the rationale for concurrent antiretroviral therapy in TB patients, because I think now it's quite widely accepted. Several studies have shown that there's no significant improvement in CD4 cell counts or in viral load when you treat patients with TB, with just anti-TB treatment, that the case fatality rates are about 40% or even 50% in many series, and that the use of concurrent HART in co-infected patients during TB treatment is associated with reduced mortality. And these two studies published quite some years ago showing the very high mortality at 24 months in patients who started TB treatment with CD4s of less than 200 and a significant mortality in the group which had CD4s of between 200 and 500. A study from Adeda et al. From London, analyzing groups of patients in the pre-HART era compared to a group treated after 1996 when they also got HART, showing that the cumulative risk of new opportunistic infections or death at 4 years was significantly less in the group that received HART. So we have to balance the question of when to start HIV, ART in HIV-infected patients. On the one hand, there's the considerable risk of mortality and other opportunistic infections developing. And on the other hand is the possibility of immune reconstitution, drug-drug interactions, and co-toxicity. However, the balance, I think, is heavily on the side of reducing mortality by starting ART early. And this decision analysis published recently looked at a hypothetical cohort of 1,000 HIV-infected adults with TB and CD4 of less than 200 who all received standard 6-month rifampicin-based DOT and one of these HART regimens. And they were divided into three groups: those who got HART during the first 2 months of ATT, the group where it was deferred and started during 2 to 6 months of ATT, and the group that received no HART at all during TB treatment. And we can see that the group that did not get HART had a very high mortality due to all causes compared to the other two groups. There was a slight difference in mortality in those patients who started treatment in the first 2 months as opposed to those who started after the first 2 months of TB treatment. However, the trade-off was that severe immune reconstitution and severe drug toxicity was much more commonly seen in the patients who received HART in the first 8 weeks of TB treatment. So it's often a very tricky decision, and one has to sometimes take it patient by patient, and you have to be prepared to deal with these complications if they do occur, because it's the patients with the most severe immunodeficiency and who need HART urgently who are also likely to develop the most severe forms of iris and drug toxicity. So the WHO recommendations that were revised, the guidelines that were revised in 2006, recommend antiretroviral treatment for all patients with CD4 less than 200 at the time of starting ATT, and this should be started between 2 and 8 weeks as soon as TB treatment is tolerated and the patient is a little stable. For those with CD4 between 200 and 350, one can start ART after 8 weeks, but it's still recommended that antiretroviral treatment be begun. For patients with CD4s above 350, one can defer ART, but it's important to reevaluate the patient periodically at the end of intensive phase and again at the end of TB treatment, and if any other stage 3 or stage 4 AIDS-defining illnesses occur, one would consider then starting ART even in this group. In areas where CD4 count is not available, it's recommended that all HIV-TB patients do get started on ART. Well, I want to spend just a minute talking about the treatment of TB in HIV, because it's accepted now that standard regimens can be used and they work equally well in HIV-infected patients. Directly observed treatment should be used wherever possible. Short course regimens have been found to be effective, and it's clear that rifampicin should be used throughout the regimen. It does much better than switching to a non-rifampicin-containing continuation phase. However, recent reports have pointed out the risk of developing acquired rifampicin resistance, particularly in patients with advanced HIV disease when intermittent therapy is used. This was believed to be restricted to once or twice weekly treatment, but it appears now that even treatment given 3 times a week can result in the development of acquired rifampicin resistance, and this is of some concern, and I think it needs urgent attention. We also need strategies to reduce recurrent rates, because as we know, the recurrent rates, both due to reactivation as well as due to reinfection with new strains, are much higher in HIV-infected than in HIV-negative populations. But whether this will continue after people get started on ART on a wider scale, one still has to study. We looked at the rifampicin and INH and pyrazinamide levels in patients who had advanced HIV disease and HIV with TB and compared it with patients who were HIV-negative TB, and found that they had significant reductions in rifampicin as in other anti-TB blood levels. And this may be one of the reasons why patients with HIV and TB don't have as good TB treatment outcomes as HIV-negative populations. Just a word about pediatric TB, the issues that we just discussed about diagnosis in the previous talk are made 10 times worse in children, because we really don't have a gold standard for TB diagnosis. And in many developing countries, other AIDS-associated lung diseases like lymphocytic interstitial pneumonitis, which can really mimic miliary TB, very often get started on TB treatment, and these children receive recurrent, repeated courses of anti-TB treatment because a diagnosis is not made. Now, having said that, one must use a rifampicin-containing regimen for the treatment of TB. Rifampicin has major effects on many of the antiretroviral drugs, including the protease inhibitors, where levels are reduced up to 80 to 90%, as well as the NNRTIs, and nevirapine levels are reduced more than efavirenz. So, since NNRTIs are the ones that are used as a backbone of treatment in most resource-poor settings, efavirenz and nevirapine exposure has been shown to be reduced 20 to 40% with rifampin, and small PK studies do support a dose increase of efavirenz to 800 milligrams and nevirapine to 300 milligrams BID when used with rifampicin. However, there's a large interpatient variability due to the genetic determinants of metabolism, due to the polymorphisms in the cytochrome P450 enzyme, and therefore it's very, very difficult to predict who's going to have high and who's going to have low blood levels. A few clinical studies that have come out of late do not support the dose adjustments of efavirenz or nevirapine when given with rifampin, and this is one recent study that looked at the nevirapine trough levels in patients at weeks 8 and 12, when they were still on anti-TB treatment with rifampin, and the same group of about 70 patients after they had completed ATT at week 60. And while there was a significant increase in the trough levels of nevirapine, there was no significant difference in the viral suppression at 60 weeks in the group of patients who received rifampicin as opposed to the group that were treated with a nevirapine-containing regimen and did not receive rifampicin. So this study also did not document any increased adverse reactions and is probably one of the first studies to show that, though this was not a randomized clinical trial, this was an observational study to show that nevirapine can be safely used with rifampin. There was an abstract presented yesterday from also from the Thai group examining the difference between nevirapine 200 BID and nevirapine 300 milligrams BID, showing that there was no difference in virological suppression, but however, there were more adverse events in the group that received higher dose of nevirapine. So for the time being, the evidence seems to suggest that we can stay with nevirapine 200 milligrams BID. And similarly, studies that have looked at efavirenz, though they found slightly higher number of patients who had subtherapeutic concentrations of efavirenz in those who received 600 milligrams, there was no difference in clinical outcome. So again, there doesn't seem to be any evidence to increase the dose of efavirenz to 800 when given with rifampicin. But however, I should add that this may vary by ethnicity as well as by body weight, again, because of the CYP polymorphisms, and we need more studies in different populations to see if the clinical outcomes are okay. So what are the options for heart regimens when given with TB treatment? Well, in countries where rifabutin is available in the developed world, the best option is probably to use a rifabutin-based TB regimen with which you can use most of the PIs and NNRTIs except dilavudine. However, in most developing countries, rifabutin is not available, and so when you either have to use a non-rifampicin-based regimen, which is not recommended and which should be done only if there's either rifampicin resistance or where DOT cannot be provided, or to use a heart with a rifampicin-based regimen. And the WHO guidelines recommend that efavirenz with a 2-NRTI backbone is a preferred regimen. The only thing is to monitor for pregnancy because of the teratogenic effect of efavirenz. The alternative is to use the nevirapine with 2-NRTI backbones, and again, one should monitor for liver functions in the first few weeks of treatment. Another alternative is to use triple NRTIs with either tenofovir or abacavir with zidovudine and lamivudine. However, these drugs are, again, not widely available in the resource-poor settings. This chart is just to show that there are dose adjustments of rifabutin when they are used, when it is used with efavirenz or with the protease inhibitors. The dose of rifabutin needs to be reduced when combined with any of the protease inhibitors. Adverse drug reactions. This small study actually pointed out the common adverse reactions that occur with concurrent ATT and heart: peripheral neuropathy, rash, gastrointestinal, hepatitis, and neurological are the common events that occur. And some of these are because of the overlapping toxicities of the drugs. 3TC is a well-tolerated drug, with usually without much of problem. The stavudine or D4T often can result in peripheral neuropathy, pancreatitis, lipoatrophy, and INH and ethambutol can aggravate peripheral neuropathy. So when you have an HIV-infected patient with severe malnutrition who may or may not be an alcoholic and who gets stavudine or DDI and INH, the risk of peripheral neuropathy is pretty high. Similarly, AZT can lead to GI intolerance, which can also occur due to some of the other anti-TB drugs. Efavirenz usually leads to some transient CNS abnormalities and rash, and rash can occur due to any of these anti-TB drugs. And finally, nevirapine can sometimes result in severe rash as well as hepatotoxicity. And again, INH, rifampicin, pyrazinamide can have overlapping toxicities. And one should not forget that cotrimoxazole also has some of these overlapping toxicities, particularly the rash and the bone marrow suppression. Cutaneous toxicity is fairly common, but it's usually mild, and severe cases are seen in less than 5%. Nevirapine is probably the commonest drug, but cotrimoxazole also can result in Stevens-Johnson syndrome. The patient has elevated liver enzymes, fever, and mucosal involvement. These are signs of severity. The drug should be discontinued immediately, and supportive management can usually improve most of these patients, but early recognition and monitoring of patients, particularly when they're started on ART and ATT, is important. Immune reconstitution syndrome has been discussed quite a lot at this meeting. It's seen quite commonly, particularly in patients with advanced immunosuppression who are starting ART. We see it in about 20 to 30% or so. And TB is the commonest form of IRS, so you can get herpes zoster, herpes simplex, cryptococcal meningitis, and other forms of IRS as well. And is usually seen with dramatically increasing size of lymph nodes, or with a worsening chest X-ray infiltrate, with increasing pleural effusions, sometimes pericardial effusion, and CNS signs. Tuberculomas can get bigger. Meningitis may be unmasked. The median time has been reported to be about 3 weeks, though we have seen IRS starting as early as 5 days after starting ART. It's due to an exuberant cytokine response, and the risk factors for IRS are high viral load, a very low baseline CD4, less than 50, starting ARV within the first few weeks of TB treatment, and having disseminated TB. In the severe cases, a short course of steroids is often required, but this should be reserved for patients who have either respiratory distress or neurological symptoms. Usually patients like this can be managed symptomatically with NSAIDs and some reassurance. We should not forget that these patients are severely immunosuppressed, and they often have other associated infections like herpes zoster or CNS toxoplasmosis. And so these also require concurrent treatment, and this further tends to complicate their management. And it's important to start all patients on cotrimoxazole prophylaxis. A word about second-line ART. Well, this is still not widely available in most of the countries where in the developing world. However, where protease inhibitors are in use, rifampicin cannot be used with atazanavir, nelfinavir, or indinavir. However, it can be used with saquinavir or lopinavir, but the dose of ritonavir boosting has to be increased, so it has to be lopinavir-ritonavir in the dose of 400-400 or saquinavir-ritonavir in the dose of 1,100 BID. However, there is an increased risk of diarrhea, of lipid abnormalities, and hepatotoxicity, so it might be worthwhile considering substituting rifampicin with either rifabutin or a fluoroquinolone, or if the patient's clinical condition permits, to complete anti-TB treatment before switching to second-line drugs. And finally, I want to end on an optimistic note, because I've talked about the challenges in the clinic of treating an individual patient, but when we're talking about large programs in our countries, TB clinics are often the entry point for HIV care. The TB program is decentralized, as been mentioned earlier. DOT is usually available at the primary healthcare level, whereas ART clinics are still very much centralized. Patients have to travel long distances, and therefore monitoring of patients for both on ART and ATT and ensuring adherence to both regimens is very, very important. But a recent publication shows that it can be done, and that patients with pulmonary or extrapulmonary TB who were started on ART had similar outcomes as patients who did not have TB. So I'll end there, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Soumya. One of the questions in therapeutics that's troubling is the looming one of second-line therapy and treating patients with TB. You mentioned some of the challenges. I guess I'd ask you about your own clinical experience with it and protease inhibitors, and actually anybody from the audience who would like to comment.
Like I mentioned, I don't have a lot of clinical experience with it because we don't have protease inhibitors available in the program, and so we've had only a handful of patients who've been able to afford these drugs. One option that we have taken is to have the patient on a fluoroquinolone-containing TB regimen. It becomes easier to manage because one doesn't want to interrupt or change their protease inhibitor regimen that they've been on.
Thanks. Microphone 2.
My name is Helen Cox from the Burnet Institute in Melbourne, Australia. I just have a question regarding direct observation of treatment. You put it up as the requirement for TB treatment. yet most patients on ART do not require direct observation. So I'm wondering if there's a contradiction there to require directly observed doses for TB treatment but not for HIV treatment. Can you comment, please?
Well, directly observed treatment for HIV has also been shown to be very effective. The problem is it's lifelong and it's not feasible. Directly observed treatment for TB is essential if one is using an intermittent regimen. So in countries or programs that use thrice weekly, like India and China, direct observation of treatment is very, very important because even missing a single dose could be very deleterious for the patient. Wherever possible, that's why I said to use DOT wherever possible, because it's been shown clearly that if you can observe and supervise patients taking TB treatment, they do much better.
Mark.
You could comment on is that one of the things that one of the side effects of TB HIV co-infection is the congregation of patients to be get their directly observed treatment, and it's been called now that it's a phase of directly observed transmission, because there's a fair amount of nosocomial transmission. In fact, even during the course of therapy, and some nice studies showing that people acquiring drug resistance actually being transmitted to them from other patients. Can you just comment on how that can be managed in a TB-HIV clinical setting?
Well, generally, directly observed treatment must be decentralized, and so you don't really want patients coming into a clinic and so on. So the way it's organized, at least in India, is the directly observed treatment is done by the village health nurse or quite often by a community dot provider in the patient's village. So I think the risk of nosocomial transmission definitely does exist in facilities where patients get admitted, either to initiate ATT and ART or to manage their complications when they're very sick. And the other possibility is now in ART clinics, but there are going to be a lot of immunosuppressed patients sitting in often very crowded facility waiting sometimes a whole day to get their drugs. So I think we have to keep that in mind.
Next microphone one.
Mark Boyd, Australia. Dr. Swaminathan, I was quite pleased that you mentioned the use of the alternative rifamycin and rifabutin in some cases, which is, of course, in the rich industrial world, what we've generally used in preference to rifampicin when we've been in the situation of having to treat both diseases at the same time. As I understand it, rifabutin has actually been off patent now for about 5 years, and you mentioned that it's unavailable, and it was certainly an expensive drug, but I just wonder if it's not time to think about getting the generic producers in your country and others to actually make rifabutin and making that available in developing countries, because, as I say, it's off patent. It may actually be quite cheap to make. Does anyone know anything about that?
I think that I'm sure that Indian generic companies will do it if it's possible. So let's hope for the best.
Mark, I think that's a good point. You know, it's come up at other meetings. It seems like somewhat of an obvious solution. So I'm not sure we can put it on Soumya's shoulders herself, but I do think as a field that we should be pushing towards. I know Jerry Friedland has also mentioned that several times in conferences. Microphone two.
Dr. Trivedi from Zambia, physician. Mine is a comment that as much as we want to start the treatment with antiretrovirals early as possible, in most cases it is not possible because of the side effects of the antitubercular drugs to start with, and then the need for starting this cotrimoxazole or prophylaxis also earlier, and then to observe that whether the patient is developing toxicity because of the cotrimoxazole or prophylaxis. So in most cases the treatment gets delayed at least by 4 weeks, even in those with the low CD4 cell counts. And the earlier WHO guidelines, before 2006 guidelines came, that patients with CD4 cell count of less than 50, they should be the candidates to start the treatment earliest. And our experience has been that these patients, when they are started on treatment at 4 weeks, they did as well as to the other patients on whom the treatment was started with the newer guidelines earlier.
Well, yeah, there's obviously no hard and fast rule, and the idea is to start as early as possible, as early as feasible. So you would wait for a patient to stabilize on the 4 anti-TB drugs and cotrimoxazole and then get going. I think that's a reasonable approach, and any time in the first 8 weeks should be okay.
Thank you. Thank you, and I just want to add that there's randomized trials now so we can make evidence-based recommendations in the future about that particular absolutely important question that the last discussion brought up. So thank you very much, Soumya. Our final speaker is Dr. Alison Grant. She's a PhD researcher. She's faculty at the London School. I know I read her work for many, many years when she was did very nice work in Côte d'Ivoire, and now she's doing some excellent work with a really exciting research group in South Africa, and she's going to be talking to us about IPT.
Thanks very much, and thank you to the organizers. It's an honor to be here. So it's the end of a long day, and so I'm going to try to make this very easy. I thought I'd try to present the answers to some frequently asked questions, or questions that perhaps should be frequently asked, about isoniazid preventive therapy, or IPT. And these are the questions that I'm going to try to address. And obviously for this audience, I'm going to focus on the use of IPT amongst people with HIV, and particularly in settings where TB is highly prevalent. So why do we use IPT, or where does this idea come from? In 1952, when isoniazid was first introduced, it was observed that children who had miliary TB and were treated with isoniazid did not go on to develop TB meningitis in the same way as they had when treated with previous regimens. And from this came the idea of using isoniazid as preventive therapy in order to treat individuals with asymptomatic TB infection to reduce the risk that they would go on to develop TB disease. Isoniazid works by inhibiting mycobacterial cell wall formation, so it's only bactericidal in dividing cells. In latent infection, there's a low rate of cell division, which may explain why you need a relatively long course of isoniazid. So clearly, from its characteristics, isoniazid is not an ideal drug to be used in the treatment of latent infection, but it's the one which has been most studied, it's well tolerated, and it's inexpensive. So, does IPT prevent TB in people with HIV? That's easy. Yes, it does. And this slide summarizes the most recent meta-analysis of clinical trials comparing IPT with placebo. And what you can see from this is that overall IPT reduces the risk of a new episode of TB by about one-third. However, when you stratify individuals according to their tuberculin skin test status, you can see that in individuals who are TST positive, the effect is much greater, with a nearly two-thirds reduction in the risk of a new episode of TB, whereas people who are TST negative get a rather smaller reduction, which is not statistically significant. So in clinical trials, it works well. Well, what about in real-life conditions or in routine clinical conditions? And we tested that in a routine HIV clinic for gold miners in South Africa in the period prior to the availability of antiretroviral therapy. And here, people who had no prior history of TB were offered a six-month course of isoniazid. And we evaluated this by comparing TB incidence in all the people who came to the clinic, comparing TB incidence before, in the period before they came to the clinic, with the period after they had been enrolled in the clinic. And what we found was that overall, there was a 38% reduction in the risk of TB, but if we restricted the analysis to people who had no prior history of TB and so were eligible to receive IPT, the risk reduction was bigger at around 46%. So far, I've been talking about giving IPT to people with no prior history for TB, and that's the groups in whom it's been most studied, but there is also some evidence to suggest that people who do have a prior history of active TB disease can also benefit from receiving IPT. And this slide summarizes three studies, two small randomized controlled trials and an observational cohort study, all showing that secondary isoniazid preventive therapy also is effective in preventing TB. So I hear you say, if it works, why aren't we using it? And I'm glad you asked that question, because it's a good one. I think a major issue is concern about isoniazid resistance, and I'm going to come back to that. But maybe there's also concern about the risk of side effects. And here, what we're most worried about is hepatotoxicity. This is rare. In the largest of the randomized controlled trials in Uganda, there were few patients who had raised transaminases, and there were only a total of 3 out of 931 who stopped because of any adverse event. When we used IPT in our routine setting in South Africa, only one individual out of nearly 800 had to stop because of asymptomatic raised AST. More recently, Chris Hoffman did an analysis of individuals taking ART to look at risk factors for hepatotoxicity, and it was reassuring to find that people taking IPT at the same time, as antiretroviral therapy, had no higher risk of hepatotoxicity. I think there are also health system issues around why IPT has not been implemented. TB clinics are the arena where traditionally contact tracing and IPT were implemented. But in many settings where there's high HIV prevalence, TB clinics are overburdened with the high caseload. And so it's very understandable that their priority is treatment rather than prevention. Until recently, availability of facilities for HIV care has also been very limited. But I think as antiretroviral rollout proceeds, and particularly with increasing emphasis on HIV testing, I think there are new opportunities for implementation of isoniazid preventive therapy as part of HIV care. And a particular example might be women who perhaps have HIV infection identified during a pregnancy. Many of them will have relatively early HIV disease, may not immediately require ART, but do have a high morbidity and mortality from TB, and so they might well benefit from IPT. So to come to the issue of IPT in the era of drug resistance, I think there are two important questions. Firstly, will IPT work? And secondly, will it make resistance worse? Clearly, if an individual has latent infection with an isoniazid-resistant organism, we can assume that isoniazid would be ineffective but wouldn't make the situation any worse. However, it's interesting to note that IPT is effective even in settings where the prevalence of isoniazid resistance is relatively high, for example, in Haiti in the 1990s. I don't think there is evidence to guide us around a threshold prevalence of isoniazid resistance above which isoniazid preventive therapy becomes futile or the risks exceed the benefits, but I think most people would agree that in settings where there's a high burden of MDR-TB, the top priority has to be optimizing TB treatment to ensure cure. So does IPT promote isoniazid resistance? Well, not if we're treating latent infection, because in latent TB, there are few organisms which divide slowly, so the risk of selecting in favor of a drug-resistant mutant will be low. Clearly, however, if a person actually has active TB and is inadvertently treated with isoniazid monotherapy, then there is a risk that will promote resistance, hence the importance of screening for TB before we give IPT. I'm coming back to that later. But even in a worst-case scenario where we miss a case of active TB, that person gets inadvertent isoniazid monotherapy and develops isoniazid resistance, then standard quadruple TB therapy will be effective. This slide summarizes data from 13 studies in which IPT was compared with control, and among TB cases, isoniazid resistance was measured. So a few caveats about this. Some of these studies had small numbers of TB cases, so large, wide confidence intervals. In some cases, the testing of isolates was incomplete, and the definition of resistance has changed over time, which complicates the interpretation. But nonetheless, this is the evidence that there is. So the box shows the point estimate for the relative risk of isoniazid-resistant TB, comparing groups receiving IPT with control. So if the box is on this side of one, then there was a higher risk of isoniazid-resistant TB in the group who received IPT compared with control. The summary relative risk for all of these studies was 1.45, but you'll notice that the confidence interval overlaps one. So I think we can't be sure that there really is a difference. We can't be sure there really is a higher risk of resistance in the groups who received IPT. But even if there was, the magnitude of that risk is small. This slide is just to illustrate a potential pitfall in interpretation of the prevalence of isoniazid resistance amongst individuals who've been treated for latent TB. If we imagine individuals with latent TB, among whom there are some who have latent infection with a resistant organism, illustrated by that red blob there, then if we treat these individuals with isoniazid, isoniazid will prevent reactivation of some of the cases of susceptible TB, but won't make any difference to those resistant isolates. So in the cases of active TB which subsequently emerge, the prevalence of isoniazid resistance will appear to be higher because we've suppressed some of the cases of resistant TB. So we end up with less TB overall, which is clearly a good thing, and an apparently higher prevalence of TB than we would if nothing had happened. Sorry, a higher prevalence of resistant TB than we would if nothing had happened. But there's actually no more. There are no more cases of resistant TB. So the evidence suggests that if there is any risk of increased resistance, the magnitude of that risk is small. In addition, it's worth keeping in mind that most resistance arises from the suboptimal treatment of active disease, and so preventing active disease could actually have an overall beneficial effect on resistance. But clearly, there's a need to continue with surveillance for resistance. I'd like to just move on to the role of IPT in the era of antiretroviral therapy, which I think is a very interesting one. Several studies have shown that ART reduces TB incidence, and this is a study from Cape Town to illustrate this, showing that as individuals have more time on ART, the incidence of TB falls. But even after several years on ART, the incidence of TB amongst these individuals remains higher than amongst HIV-negative counterparts. And just to explore that a little more, here are some data from an analysis we did looking at risk factors for TB amongst people taking antiretroviral therapy in the UK. And I've shown quite a lot of data just for completeness, but I just want to draw your attention to this, which is the very strong association between the most recent CD4 count and the risk of tuberculosis. So even when people are on antiretroviral therapy, particularly if their CD4 count is low, their risk of TB may remain quite high. So ART reduces TB incidence, IPT reduces TB incidence. What about putting them together? Would that be even better? And there are some data from the TRIO study in Rio to show that this may be the case. So in this analysis, which is a retrospective cohort study amongst individuals attending HIV clinics in Rio, TB incidence has been estimated looking at groups subdivided according to whether they were taking antiretroviral therapy or IPT alone, or neither, or both. And what you can see is that even though the numbers of cases of TB in the IPT groups are fairly small, so again, the confidence intervals are quite wide, it does suggest that the incidence of TB in people taking both ART and IPT is lower than in either alone. And the main TRIO study is going to go on to investigate this in more detail. I just wanted to mention a more radical use of IPT, which we're currently investigating in South Africa. And this is giving community-wide IPT in the South African gold mines, where, as you probably know, the incidence of TB is extremely high, around 3,000 to 4,000 per 100,000. And so this is a cluster randomized study in which the clusters are gold mine shafts and their employees. And the intervention is to offer screening for active TB to all the employees at each of the intervention shafts. Those who are found to have active TB are treated, and those who don't have active TB are offered treatment for latent infection. And with 9 months of IPT, and the aim here is to radically reduce TB transmission. So doing well so far, 8,000 recruited, only 30,000 still to go. So what more do we need to know? Well, I've mentioned, I think we do need to know more about how to best use IPT and ART to optimal effect. I think we also need to know how long to give IPT for. Most of the studies have evaluated 6 months, but there are reasons to believe that longer may be better, and there are studies going on in South Africa and Botswana to look at that. I think an important issue is how to exclude active TB. I've mentioned earlier the importance of screening for active TB prior to IPT. And it's quite difficult to summarize the studies on this. I think in brief, there are conflicting results over the value of a chest X-ray in addition to a symptom screen. And you've heard plenty about the difficulties of TB diagnostics. So this is just using existing technology, which, as you've heard, is really suboptimal. It's difficult to make comparisons between the studies because inclusion criteria are often different, and even the gold standard used for TB diagnosis is different. And I think my conclusion is that we need more studies, but those are ongoing. And finally, I think there's an issue about how to maximize adherence to IPT. Adherence to IPT has traditionally been dismal, frankly, and not just in the setting of HIV infection, but more generally, even among physicians in the United States who presumably should know better. And this slide illustrates the problem. So this is looking at a study of IPT in Zambia, where by the sixth month of IPT, only 23% of people who started IPT had returned to pick up their tablets. And when we were doing some preliminary work before our community intervention in South Africa, we did some focus groups with mine workers to find out what they knew about TB. And they were actually very knowledgeable about TB. They knew that it was a serious disease. They knew a lot about it. But they had heard absolutely nothing about treatment to prevent TB. And I think maybe we have something to learn here from the very successful treatment literacy campaigns that have been going on, have been very successful in ART programs. So maybe we can learn from that, and maybe our patients, our HIV-infected patients, clearly they need to know about TB, but maybe they also need to know about TB preventive therapy, and maybe they'll then go and badger their healthcare provider until they're given it. So in conclusion, I'd just like to quote Cole Porter and say, let's do it. And I'd like to just acknowledge some of the colleagues who I've been working with over the last few years. And thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Allison. Microphone two.
Artis Mo from UCLA Los Angeles. Thank you very much for your presentation, Dr. Grant. I was curious to know, did you ever do a cost-effectiveness analysis about the cost of screening, excluding those people with active TB, with the cost of the drug over the period of time, to see if it was cost-effective in preventing a single case of TB?
Thanks. We did do that in our evaluation of the clinic-based implementation of IPT. And in short, I can't remember the number in US dollars, I'm afraid, but in short, it worked out well. And that was even with fairly extensive screening, including doing cultures for TB.
Nelson, can you comment on the pediatric population IPT?
Sorry?
Can you comment on the pediatric population, the data with IPT?
So, I mean, this I've been talking really very much about adults. I think there are some data on the use of IPT. There's a study from Cape Town. I don't know if anybody's here from that. But IPT was found to reduce mortality amongst children, amongst HIV-infected children. I don't know those data very well. I know there are more studies ongoing in children.
Mark? Hello. In the absence of still effective screening procedures in resource-limited settings, you still want to do IPT?
I think it's difficult because, as I say, we are faced with suboptimal diagnostics. I think we could at least start with perhaps patients in whom it would be less difficult to exclude active disease. People with very advanced disease, that's going to be a problem. But what about pregnant women, perhaps? Those are pregnant women, or particularly after delivery, they're likely to have less advanced disease. Exclusion of TB in those individuals should present less of a problem, and they have a lot to gain.
Just a quick comment. The patients who may have the most severe immunosuppression may have, in fact, the TB. It's most difficult to diagnose because it's in extrapulmonary, et cetera. There's been some preliminary data suggest that after initiation of treatment, you release a lot of TB antigens from organisms, and it might be at that point easier to detect. Hard to imagine using as a routine diagnostic, but in the setting of starting IPT, it offers a tantalizing possibility to try to see if we could use that as a screening test for replicating organisms in patients starting IPT.
Okay, thank you, Allison. I'd like to thank the speakers and the audience for their excellent discussion. I'd also like to refer those of you in the audience to the photography display upstairs at the top of the escalator called The Shack. It is by Damian Schumann, and it's a really powerful display of people living with HIV and TB in sub-Saharan Africa. So thank you very much.